the program has changed. And that's beyond our control. We need to alert governments and others who are here from civil society. We apologize, but actually the apologies on behalf of the NCMP powers that be. So between Nkululeko and Mangweni, the secretary and I, we discussed it on a case-by-case basis. As you'll recall, previously we decided to stick to the 4:30 arrangement because the stakeholder, and there's only one there, we felt shouldn't be asked to change again. So there was a negotiation between Treasury, the stakeholders, and ourselves. While the committee's secretaries agreed we'll start at 10. So I apologize for that. In Kululeko, have we got any... I apologize, I do so on behalf of not the committee, but the NCOP powers that be, let me remind you. This is beyond our control. It's regrettable that this happens at the last minute, and the explanations are never convincing in my view. Okay. So shall we hand over then to Nkululeko? Any minutes, any apologies?
No apologies, chairperson, good money.
So everybody's meant to be here who's meant to be here, right? Who should be here, who's meant to be here. Okay, then fine. How many, up till yesterday, we had the one submission. I see this morning you sent an email again. Now, how many submissions have we got?
With the one that I sent you this morning, chairperson, we have two. But only one is going to be presenting.
That's right. That only one is coming for. Yeah. Just to remind the staff and Treasury, you have to respond to both those who are here today for a oral presentation and those who have sent written submissions, right, Treasury? And as discussed with you yesterday via Nkululeko, instead of losing another 3 days, we will have the response today, though it may not be a final response and will carry over as the meeting proceeds. Is Frank here?
Yes, chairperson, he is.
Yeah, we might seek some legal advice on that. All right, let's hand over then. Look, as there's only one oral submission, we can give them all time. Nkululeko, did you negotiate 15 minutes with them?
I negotiated 10 minutes, chairperson, with them.
I thought I said 15 because, given that there aren't other submissions, maybe I didn't convey that to you. That's what... ran through my head. That's what I thought, and perhaps I didn't say it to you. So misunderstanding. You can have 15 minutes, and if you want to, up to 20 minutes. Excuse me, because sometimes people come, colleagues from civil society, people come at the last minute and want to make an oral submission. It's not our want to say no. We usually say yes, unless there's some overwhelming reason why we can't accommodate them. So you can have between 15 and 20 minutes. We will then put questions to you, you can reply, and then Treasury can come in and we have what Treasury has to say to what you're saying, and of course there will be an attentive response from them because they might need to mull over what you said this morning apart from your written submission, and if need be, they'll come back to us again to give a further presentation on their response to what you're saying, and then if you want, you can be there too. But for now, that's the program, and then if there's time and space, we will, within the 3 hours, begin to look at the bill more carefully. Over then to our friends from civil society who are here.
Chair, good morning, and thank you very much to the committee, Honourable Chair, and for members. We are the National Clothing and Retail Federation of South Africa. We are we're with our team of attorneys from Bowman's. We also have some industry members here. If I could just, for way of outline, indicate that the NCRF membership includes Woolworths, the Foschini Group, Mr. Price Group, Truworths, Pick and Pay Clothing, Cotton on LA Group, Queen's Park, Cape Union Mart. It's a substantial collection of clothing retailers that is represented. And for the purpose of this presentation, the concerns, of course, play out to the consumers who are serviced by those clothing retailers. Chair, thank you very much for extending the time for us. We were going to just ask for a little extra time, and we do appreciate the opportunity that the committee has given us to just make our submission with just a little bit more time. Chair, the substance and our industry emphasis will come from the specific retailer representatives in the room, and the legal emphasis will come from the lawyers, and they will introduce themselves as they speak. But our key submission here rotates around the fact that what we have here is a piece of legislation which we as retailers respond to by saying one size does not affect the door. We're very concerned about the fact that a number of consumers and potential consumers who are part of the developing as credit seeking consumers responsibly are going to be prejudiced, and we will speak to that a lot more specifically over time. I'm going to hand over without any delays then and to the presentation. We do have a slide presentation. If I could just we could share the thing. Thank you, Chair. Everyone can see that in the top thing. If it's not possible, please let us know. But what we are going to do is just take the committee through the presentation. We have submitted both the slide deck, and we did send in, and we apologize for the late submission, but we've been working with very difficult deadlines, and you've
indicated. We got it. Fine, we understand. We got it.
Good. So, Chair, I'm going to hand over then, and I'm going to ask our, for legal emphasis to start off. Karen will start us off and just introduce herself, and then we will go straight over to moving along through the presentation with any questions afterwards. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. My name is Karen Mason McCann. I'm an attorney in the Banking and Financial Services Regulatory Practice at Bowman. I'll jump straight into the presentation. The reason why we're here today is because of the proposed inclusion by way of item 11A of including all a person who carries on the business of a credit provider as defined in the National Credit Act as an accountable institution. So that's the basis of why we're here, and that will, our presentations will, our submissions are based on that specific inclusion. So just by way of background, the NCRS has made a submission to the Standing Committee on Finance in the National Assembly regarding this proposed draft change. The current draft amendment, as we are very aware and cognizant, is based on the Financial Action Task Force standards, which requires effectively active lending to be included in the scope of a country's measures against money laundering and terrorist financing. We would like to emphasize that the NCR is very mindful of this, and we are cognizant of that, but notwithstanding the reasoning behind the inclusion, the NCR formally objects to the blanket inclusion of credit providers as is currently proposed in draft 11A in light of the drastic and materially adverse unintended consequences that such an inclusion will have not only on the NCRF members as credit retailers, but also specifically on retail credit consumers. As a result, the NCRF members have proposed an alternative wording because they, as I said, are cognizant of the what is being sought to achieve by the specific inclusion. So I'll just read, I'll take you through it, and I would like to say that the underlined portion is what we are specifically proposing as an alternative. So the first phrase is how it sits at the moment in the draft, a person who carries on the business of a credit provider as defined in the National Credit Act, excluding credit providers offering credit as provided for in Section 81A, read with 83, in circumstances where the credit facility in question constitutes a closed-loop revolving credit scorecard where a credit limit is available to the consumer and an installment is payable monthly. I'll just pause there and say specifically what's quite important here is that we're proposing a closed-loop environment, so, and we'll maybe speak more on that point later. But I'm cognizant of time, so that's the proposal.
Hang on, excuse me. We are not technical experts, okay?
Okay.
We are politicians. We were elected not because of our financial and technical skills. Ideally, we should have people like that in our committee, and our staff assist us in that regard. So can I plead with you to use simple language and explain things to us simply, and also where you use technical terms, please explain them simply. Thank you.
Okay. No problem at all. So what we are proposing is we are proposing that we exclude registered credit provider to provide credit facilities as defined in the National Credit Act. So that part is section 81A read with 83. So those are the providers of credit facilities. However, we are cognizant that if you give a wholesale exclusion to credit facilities generally, that could exclude a large portion of credit providers. So that's why we propose in the second section, after the comma, after 8.3, where we said specifically we are trying to exclude what that means in practice is members of the NCR that effectively have store credit cards where you can only use those cards to buy merchandise in that specific store. That's a closed loop environment. So that's what we're proposing. The NCR members, their store cards don't let you make a purchase on credit from a different shop or a different facility. It's within that specific store. So that NCR member, you are limited to making a credit purchase in that store. That's why it's closed loop. And the revolving credit store card is just to bring in the legal concept of how they effectively provide the credit, and that's to meet with the definition of the National Credit Act. So I'll just call it there, and then you can let me know if that sufficiently explains the proposed wording or if you have any other questions.
Well, I will let you speak, but colleagues, can I suggest me, unless somebody has an objection, and please arrange it now, let's not force them to squeeze what they're saying into the 15 or 20 minutes. So I don't think we should put you under pressure in a situation where this is quite, comrades, colleagues, a technically complex bill. So does anybody object for them or to them? Excuse me, I've got this reflux problem. You'll have to excuse me. That's effectively bad news morning. So I apologize for that. Look, very quickly, is there anybody objecting to up to 25 minutes? But remember, you'll be asked several questions, and so by the end of it, you'll have spoken far more than those 25 minutes. Can I see any hands up against 25 minutes? So at least we have a better understanding of the technical concept. It helps us to progress faster on the processing of the bill. Any hands up? I don't see any hands up. Are there any in Kulileko?
Yes, Mr. Ryder.
As usual, Chair, you wouldn't expect me not to say something. But no, I think this is a good opportunity for us to learn. So I would agree with you and say 25 minutes or as much as we need, because I think this is a good opportunity to unpack the contents of this thing and have expert advice given to us.
Yeah, no, okay, so let's settle for up to half an hour if we have to. But don't be laborious, don't waste our time and your time, you're busy people. What I'm saying short is, look, the National Credit Act doesn't fall under us, as you know, it falls under the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, but those of us who've been around for thousands of years, like myself, have come across it in various forms. We've had joint meetings with that committee, declaring we remember and so on. So let's move on it. You've got up to half an hour. Thank you. But you see, your last explanation, although I knew most of it, you sort of affirmed for me that I understood, but please remember we have new members here. Well, it came to Parliament in 2019. Thank you. But I also don't understand these concepts. It's not about them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair. So that's the proposed alternative wording for item 11A of Schedule 1 of FICA. I'll leave that there because it doesn't seem that there are any current questions, and I'm going to hand over to Jane Fisher to take you through the next slide.
Okay, so we have looked at the practical implications if we were going to implement the draft item as it's currently stipulated. So we have asked for retail store cards to be excluded and to be a carve-out in that section. But if there wasn't, what we're saying is by including this in this regulation, you're actually making it subject to the same kind of regulation that a bank would be subject to, which is the Know Your Customer, and that includes the proof of residence. Now, we have looked at the data from the regulator, and we said, well, how many customers actually apply for credit at our stores? It's about 11 million in a year. And we give out about 5.5 million credit facilities each year, all with the sole aim of just buying merchandise. That's what it's there for. It's not for anything else. It's pure to buy merchandise at our stores. And that limit that we typically give a customer is around about 3,500 or 3,300. So it's small limits that we're giving out to our customers. Because we're not trying to make money off credit. What we're trying to do here is sell merchandise. And we offer credit to enable consumers to buy the merchandise. Now, the practical reality is if we had to introduce this regulation, about 30 to 40% of the consumers just wouldn't be able to prove where they live. And we're saying that then means we wouldn't be able to lend to those customers. So now you're going to be excluding around about 3.5 to 4.5 million customers from actually being able to access that credit and be able to buy that kind of merchandise. And we're saying, you know, that's a barrier to entry for the credit market. It's at odds with what the ANCA is trying to do. And it's also contrary to the, you know, the terms of financial inclusion. Every customer should be able to access credit. So we're saying, you know, we saw this previously with some of the ANCA regulations. And when we had to, you know, for the affordability regulations, there was impractical amendments to that. And we saw the impact that that had and that court case that we actually went through with. So we have seen the impact of what regulation can do and whether it works or it doesn't work and does it achieve its stated aim. The next slide actually talks about what... I think that has been up the entire time. Then we've actually looked at the costs. So what does it actually mean? Because compliance costs limits to implement compliance. And you want to implement good compliance. So we have said, you know, if we have a look at this, it would cost us round about 25 to 30 rand per credit application to just be able to do these kind of compliance checks. So that would cost round about 275 million, 330 million rand just to implement this kind of compliance. Now, of course, that would be a cost that we would have to bear as a retailer. And, you know, that impacts our profitability and how much, you know, how many jobs we can create, how many stores we can implement, and how much employment we can give. And that would just have an undesirable outcome. Nobody wants to have to shut stores, not employ as many people, purely because we've got more costs for compliance that are not adding value. So what we're saying is, the cost burden for this is disproportionate to the level of the money laundering financial terrorist risk that actually would happen. People just don't use retail credit to do money laundering or finance terrorist activities. I don't know if there are any questions about the practical considerations that we've highlighted there. Okay.
Thank you very much. My name is James McKinnell. I'm a partner at Bowman's, and I'll be speaking about a potential constitutional issue which may arise with the promulgation of these regulations in their current form. And if I may just go slightly slowly, I'd like to go back because the previous case which James spoke about, which the Federation was compelled to bring successfully to set aside the previous regulation, the so-called affordability assessment regulation, I think it's very important that we focus on that because our advice and senior counsel's advice is that this situation is analogous and may and the same situation may result and we would obviously prefer to avoid that. So what that case dealt with, it also dealt with retail store cards. The so-called affordability assessment regulations which were then proposed and which were promulgated and came into effect, what they required is that credit providers had to validate gross income of credit seekers, people who were going to be given credit. They had to validate their gross income. And for people who were formally employed, it was not a difficulty because they had payslips. For people who were in the bank community and who had bank accounts, similarly, it was not difficult for them because they could produce their bank statements. But what this case centered on is those people and the millions of people who were recipients already of credit, but who were not able to produce formal payslips or bank statements. They were people who were effectively informally employed or self-employed. And what the regulations contemplated is that the only way that they could validate their gross income was to provide what were called financial statements. And the case centered on that. And the Federation said that these regulations, and I think it's very important to stress, it was clearly not the intention of the regulations, but you'll all be aware that it's not just intention which can be struck down, it is the impact of the regulations. And the impact of those regulations was that some of the poorest members of society, people who were informally or self-employed, were simply unable to validate their gross income and were therefore effectively excluded. And that's what the case centered on. It was discrimination against that sector of credit seekers, the informally or self-employed. And that, I think, brings one to what was filed in that case in the Western Cape High Court. And I don't want to just read a long quote to you, but I think it's important just to stress what the judge found. And Judge Engers found there that, in my view, in discriminating against a section of the population that represents the less privileged and probably also many previously disadvantaged in a manner that is not fair, the regulation falls foul of any quoted sections of PAPUDA, the Promotion of Equality of, and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act. He found that it was in contravention of that. And then he went a little further. He didn't make a finding, but he said that the Federation had also submitted the contravened Section 9(3) of the Constitution because it effectively discriminated on the basis of race. Obviously, that was never the intention of the minister and would never be the intention. But it may well be, he said, an unintended result. If so, he said, it would offend against 9(3), but he made no finding. So he didn't say that it was unconstitutional, but he expressed the view that if it had that impact, then it would be. Now, we think it's analogous because if one thinks about what is being considered here, in that case, credit seekers would have to provide proof of their financial statements because they didn't have pay slips and they didn't have bank statements. Here, they would need to provide proof of residence. And you've heard and you've read the submission that the Federation's members estimate that between 30 and 40% of credit, people who already have credit, would simply be unable to comply with this regulation, which is very strict. And they would effectively be excluded, and maybe not immediately, but within a matter of months, they would be swept into the FICA net, and they would then be excluded from the credit that they already have, from the responsible, well-regulated credit industry which exists. They would be excluded from that. And so we say that that is analogous, and obviously unintended, but if it has that impact, the indirect and obviously unintended impact, but if it has that impact, then it would offend. And we say that for the same reasoning which was held in the previous case, the same judgment with respect would apply and the same consequence would potentially pertain, and the regulations we say would be subject to being struck down on that basis as well. And it's obviously not something which the Federation wishes to do, but it would have no alternative given the very serious impact on a material number of its existing customers. It would have no alternative but to consider doing that. So that is why we raise this, just to alert the honourable members and through the honourable chair to what is what happened before and why we say that's analogous and what hopefully can be avoided occurring again.
Thank you. So in support of the alternative wording that's been proposed by the NCRF members, we'd just like to point out that as far as we can tell, the Financial Intelligence Centre did not conduct a sector study for the inclusion of credit providers as an accountable institution, which, if that is the case, in our view, is surprising and irrational. It is the NCRF members' view that because of the nature of the business being conducted by the members, as we said, it's a closed-loop environment in the form of retail store credit, it translates into a very low, as the MLTF is money laundering terrorist financing risk. So because of the nature of their business, it is the NCRF's view that that is a very low risk. So objectively, it's a low risk. We'd like to point out that at the moment, if you look at the draft amendments to Schedule 1 of FICA, there's a new inclusion of the high-value goods dealers, and they become an accountable institution at a transaction value of 100,000 Rand or more. Whereas credit providers, and specifically the NCRF members, have demonstrated that the credit facility that they provide is an average facility which is around 3,300 Rand. So you've got a very big disproportionate disjunct between who is being caught by these draft amendments. And it's that in our view that what the NCRF is proposing as an alternative is more proportionate to the relative to mischief that is being seeking to prevent. We'd also like to point out that Botswana implemented a knee-jerk response as a result of being FATF waitlisted, which had untenable results, and it has since had to be walked back. So we'd also like to put that in before the committee, because that's something that we think should be prevented. And then the NCRF is really strongly of the view, and we agree, that the committee should insist that the FIC conduct an MLTA risk assessment on the credit provider sector before 11A of Schedule 1 is implemented. It's also nice to point out, and we are aware that the FIC has expressed previously that they aren't supportive of carve-outs to Schedule 1 FICA. Nonetheless, the fact remains that carve-outs to Schedule 1 FICA do exist. That's inescapable. Non-life insurers and authorized financial services providers to intermediate non-life insurance are currently excluded from being considered accountable institutions based on the fact that there's a low MLTF risk in those sectors. So because it is the NCRF's view that the MLTF risk for its members is objectively low, they have a reasonable and legitimate expectation that its industry and its members will be afforded the same consideration and treatment as those already carved out in Schedule 1 of FICA. So in conclusion, the practical implications of the implementation of Draft 11A for credit providers as defined in the NCA and the retail credit consumers, which we cannot lose sight of, is far-reaching, undesirable, and unnecessary in the NCRF members' view. As a result, the NCRF asks for a carve-out in accordance with the wording as we proposed in the submission and as we briefly gone through again in the presentation. And as there hasn't been an MLTF risk assessment conducted by the FIC to demonstrate the practical impact to South African consumers, as demonstrated in this presentation, the current effective impact of Draft 11A as it stands, it excludes such a large proportion of consumers from accessing credit, which is so important to so many people in South Africa, that we think that if there's no other recommendation that the committee can come to, that such a study is necessary to determine where we are, and this carve-out is one of the ways to exclude the practical impact for so many people. Thank you.
So, who's there? Are you done?
No, I'm done. Thank you very much.
Is that it?
More
time. Okay, all right. Then in that case, well, fine. Members, what are your comments, questions, whatever? Whose hand is up? Dennis? Yeah, I see your hand up. Okay, Dennis, go for it.
Yeah, good morning again to everybody, and thanks for the presentation. So I note that the presentation is from the retail clothing industry. Which is interesting because there's a number of different retail kind of groupings that provide finance, and I think clothing is certainly the one that I have the biggest degree of sympathy for, and I think that it's often a step up for people in the bottom end of the market. Now, my first job that I got as a young First National Bank employee, way back whenever it was, I couldn't afford to buy a suit. So I got an Edgar's account that I opened up in 1990, and I mean that has stood me in good stead over the years, and in fact has also funded a suit a little while back for my appearance in Parliament. So I have a degree of sympathy towards the clothing sector, and I think that the point is well made that they do often provide that step up and that initial tier of credit where credit would be difficult to obtain for people that would not otherwise qualify in terms of normal lending criteria from the banks, etc. I do think that there are other sectors within the retail market which are a little more abusive and perhaps do things a little bit differently. And I mean, also having lived in a mining town, I know exactly what happens on payday when people rush out and buy, you know, higher-end goods like furniture and so on, and then pawn them off towards the end of the month when the brandy runs out. So I think perhaps a differentiated approach is also important. And I wonder if a way of achieving that would be to tie some of the compliance issues around store card limits and also turnover through the accounts. And it's just something that struck me now. I think in order to differentiate and also in order to mitigate risk. And I think that we do need to know as well. The FATF, one of their primary or their first, in fact, measurement relates to assessing risk and applying a risk-based approach. And I think certainly this is relevant here. So applying a risk-based approach and certainly I think that putting some sort of a limit on the size of the transactions and the turnover through the account. You know, if someone is buying stuff, you know, maxing out their account once a month and then settling it the following month, that should raise a red flag and at least cause some sort of concern and perhaps a little bit of a heightened due diligence process on that customer. So perhaps we can get comments around mitigating the risk through looking at things like limits and turnover. I've mentioned about excluding marginalized people. That is quite important. The interesting thing that was mentioned that hadn't struck me before is the fact that, of course, there would be retrospective application, certainly in terms of the know your customer issue. And like I say, I opened my Ebiz account, chairperson, in 1990 or 1991, around there. And I don't think Edgar has much of a clue where I am now. They know where to find me, but I don't think they know where I live anymore, and they don't know much else about me. But certainly, I think going back and doing this would be a really costly, tedious, time-consuming, labor-intensive process. And then we're going to find ourselves following a similar process that Fika's been through. And I certainly don't believe that the retail stores have got the structures in place to go and set up an entire FICA compliance type of setup like the banks have done. Perhaps then a question for Mr. Davidson to answer, if you can tell me, does this type of financing fall under the DNFBP? So let's just get to what that means. It's a designated non-financial business and professions. Now, in terms of the FATF, and of course, I mean, we must always understand these regulations have been proposed in order to mitigate the impact of the FATF grey listing situation that we're in. And there are two specific measures in terms of their 40 measures that they have. There are two that speak specifically to designated non-finance businesses. Perhaps if Mr. Davidson can just tell us if the retail clothing segment would fall into that, it would be interesting. And then of course the risk to our compliance with the FATF requirements. If there is a court challenge on these regulations, perhaps Mr. Davidson again, and I mean this question is again more towards Mr. Davidson than towards the presenters. Perhaps you could let us know, you know, if there is a court challenge, if there is a something that gets put out, are we going to find that that's going to affect our ability to comply timeously with the FATF's requirements? And then perhaps in closing, Chair, perhaps a comment that I'd like Bowman's to comment on, and I think they spoke about the fact that there hadn't been a study conducted, that these regulations appear to be fairly arbitrary and almost I think the word was used, or the phrase was used, one size fits all. And it's my contention that in trying to comply with the FATF's issues that they highlighted and the non-compliance that they highlighted, it appears that we've gone with a massive, you know, well, let's just kill everything. No, that's perhaps an unfair phrase. Let's just put in a very strong covering everything type of law and try and over-comply. without thinking of the knock-on effects in that. And I do believe that in order to achieve compliance, it's going to take the this specific segment of the market several, if not many years, to reach any sort of level of compliance. And if we are putting regulations out there that are effectively setting us up for failure, I think we stand the risk of being on a grey list for substantially longer time, because you know we're the ones that set the regulations, and if they're not enforceable, if our own regulations are not enforceable, the FATF I think is going to start questioning us. So I do think that this has been a knee-jerk reaction, and just we'll just put it in. And I really believe that this clause or these, yeah, so the proposed wording I think is reasonable. I'm not sure I would have written it exactly the same, but I do think that in terms of popping up some sort of a risk flagging mechanism, certainly the size of the credits, that's been given out and the turnover through the accounts would be the two that I would flag. Chair, those are my comments. Thank you very much.
Anybody else wants to come in? Do you see anybody in Kuleleko?
No, Chair, there are no more hands.
Okay. Well, firstly, I just want to ask your team there from the NCRF, what did National Treasury say? Obviously, they gazetted the bill with the amendments. Well before they brought it to Parliament. Did you make submissions then? If so, what was their response? Then tell us a bit more about, tell us about what was SCOF's response to Standing Committee and Finance. Then maybe this is a question Treasury can answer, if FICA is here, they can answer. Does FICA always do a sector study? From what I'm told, or we told, there are carve-outs anyway in terms of what you provide for. Excuse me, then a question really to Treasury. But insofar as the stakeholder here is able to say anything, you may do so too. What is FATF requiring? Are they requiring that people living in informal settlements are required to provide proof of residence and so on, although of course now that's a requirement to have the vote. So as I understand it, a very large percentage of people, percentage-wise, of the voting population have proof of residence facility, so they can prove their residence, because they have to do so now in terms of a constitutional court decision, if I recall correctly, to vote. So it will be easier for them to provide proof of residence. Is that not so? Maybe some of these questions are better answered by Treasury, you are listening, and others in your team. So is this a requirement by FATF? And if so, I mean, isn't this unfair to developing societies? I mean, a large percentage of our population in the South do, in fact, live in informal settlements. Then the experience of Botswana, maybe Treasury should respond to that. Now, on the issue of constitutional challenges, I see what you presented. It certainly looks credible, Treasury. And I agree with, needless to say, with Dennis on this. By the way, I like that radio, Dennis, in your study or whatever room it is you are speaking from. And I'm pleased to see you've got a South African flag there, rather than a DA one. But anyway, I like the radio. Now, about the constitutional challenges. Now, Tracy, we should reply, because Dennis is right. The same thought that struck me. That, you know, do you really want to take a chance if you're not sure about it? And it seems there's some parallel. Maybe there isn't. I'm not a lawyer. But it's on the surface, to me at least, it seems there's some parallel, about parallel between the judgment made earlier and the restriction you have here.
Now, it's also true, isn't it, Treasury, that government as a whole, Parliament too, has been preoccupied with this, that the businesses provide credit far too freely, and then people find they're worse off in the longer term than they were before they got the credit. Obviously, you can ask the more experienced MPs here every now and then. When people don't get their way, I'm not saying this applies here, I'm just alerting you that we are a bit cautious when people say, well, if you go ahead and do this, the skies will fall down, the courts will rule against you, etc., right? And most times, not all, most times you find it doesn't happen. People like almost use the constitutionality of a bill, or its unconstitutionality is a threat to Parliament to proceed on a clause that they can't win through policy means. I'm not saying you're doing it, I'm just saying that we're very cautious when we hear these things. Maybe it's a bit unfair, but maybe Advocate Jenkins, you might want to say something on that. Maybe it's too soon, but you will come back to us and suggest from Parliament side. Although you can't tell what court will ultimately decide, but you can tell us, at least from your point of view or the point of the Legal and Services Unit, you know, what you think. Is this a substantial challenge that should be taken very seriously, or you can't say, or you don't think it's a serious enough challenge? excuse me. Now, excuse me. I think some other notes here, but I can't understand my shorthand. There's 2 points. Oh, I don't know what I'm talking about. So I'll come back to it. So on the one hand, we don't want to be delayed by, especially by a constitutional decision against us. And on the other hand, we don't want to be like not proceeding simply because it always hovers above us when it comes to policy issues. That if you don't give in to what we're saying, we're rushing to court. Now, my view on that is, you have a right to go to court and let the courts decide. We are not lawyers, and we seek legal advice from Parliament, and we ask Treasury for their lawyers to give us their opinions, and we can hear your lawyers as we've done this morning. But ultimately, it's for the courts to decide, though we want to tread carefully on this particular bill because of its importance. Finally, may I put a question to all the lawyers here? I mean, would it be, it's a question not just to lawyers, to anybody who can offer insight, would it cause the world to collapse, our world, South Africa, if the rest of the bill was found to be constitutionally sound and may not even be challenged, but this part is found to be unconstitutional? And obviously, FATF will say, to fix that, you've tried, your court has said no, but that's not going to affect our decision on grey listing or otherwise. So I haven't been very clear in my questions, I agree. It's not my best morning, but you know, I like others in the committee, we need time actually. I heard from Nkululeko that until Friday there was no submission. And secondly, clearly I see your hands up, I'll come to you in a moment. Oh, man, Njalo, you should chair this meeting. I'm not in a good space, dude. I'm really being troubled. I've got a slight flu emerging as well. So, look, what was I saying? I've forgotten now. So look, basically what I'm saying is, we've got to find the right balances. I personally, National Treasury colleagues from civil society, I am unconvinced really that if this part of all the amendments made were found to be unconstitutional, that it would lead FATF to conclude that, you know what, we are not meeting the requirements. Now, I also need to point out that this committee, across all parties, but particularly the ANC, I would like to say, we have
consistently held the view that the poor cannot be marginalized and excluded by policy decisions, regulation, or legislation we pass in this parliament. We're very clear about that. But we are also clear that the poor and low-income earners have also borne the consequences, not just here but globally, of those who seek to secure profits from them. And often we find, when it comes to the private sector, I'm not saying it applies to your colleagues from civil society, but you have to listen to us because these are all the trade-offs and balances we have to think about. We know that in search of their own material self-interest, the profit interest, business is always using the poor as an example of who would suffer the most. And it seems to me that given the higher percentage of people who do have a proof of residence, I'm not utterly clear, as it is, it's too early for us to grow any. Colleagues, can I just say, let's not have knee-jerk reactions. Let's think this thing through. It's more complex than I thought it would be. And we don't want to rush into making decisions. A few days delay in processing this poll is not going to be the end of the world. Treasury also understood that they'll get this poll through two houses by the end of October. So what I'm saying is, you also have to understand, colleagues from the Federation and your lawyers, that we get this all the time. You know, people, not in your case necessarily, will apply very high charges and so on, or will secure a lot of profits and then present it not as affecting them, but the poor and lower income earners of the country. And finally, we need to explain to you, if you don't already know, I'm sure your lawyers do, excuse me, that we have limited legal authority to change this bill. It's not a bill that affects the provinces directly. It's a national bill. And we have limited space, but as the NCOP, we have a constitutional obligation to act, and we need people to refer this section back to the NA committee. Also, we haven't really looked carefully at your submission, we have to admit. Now, I know that we were meant to meet at 5 o'clock, but that can't be an excuse, strictly speaking, because the deadline was 12 o'clock yesterday. And whether the meeting was at 5 o'clock or 4.30, as I understood it to be, or 10 a.m. as it's come to be, the deadline was yesterday. Nevertheless, we won't sort of focus too much, and I just draw that to your attention. Finally, the submission from Vodacom, I've had a look at it, and it's a very short one, and maybe Treasury, your initial replies to that should be offered too. But they have made a short submission, which came to us very late, and Nkululeko has sent it out now to the members. So that's a separate issue, but just draw your attention to this, that we're not going to ignore anybody who makes a submission after the deadline, and you're welcome, as indeed you are, anybody, to make submissions right from the time we vote on the bill. But how much of considered attention we can give it when it comes very late, it depends. We have sometimes been able to do so, and other times, just skim through what people say and do the best we can. So, I see Dikileli's hand is up, please.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to all the participants on the platform and the members. My apologies, Chair. I know protocol doesn't allow that I should speak after you. I just experienced the technical
glitches. There's no such protocol. There's no rule. There never has been a rule. I don't know where that comes from. Maybe in the AC. But with due respect, there's no such thing. And it has happened. So please go ahead, Chair.
Yeah, from what I understand, Chair, I don't speak after you. But thanks for your indulgence for allowing me to speak after you have spoken. I want to acknowledge and appreciate that you made a disclaimer that we are not financial expert. We are not a technical expert, but also we have the legal gurus within Parliament who might be able or who will be able to assist us in terms of analyzing what is presented here. And you have covered me. I had some of the issues that you and Dennis and the presenters have had because of the technical glitches that I experienced, but I have had some. You know, we correctly said, I might raise things that are generic or things that represent my constituency, and including myself in there as a person who comes from the previously disadvantaged or the disadvantaged or the rural area. Talking about this issue of FICA, you know, wanting FICA as a requirement. I mean, implementing FICA as a requirement to have to require bank statements, payslip, if not a bank statement or a residential proof. I think some of the retail stores, they are abusing this. I don't want to call names because you are here representing a group, but there is a popular one that I think it abuses this, but I think we need time to understand what these amendments are and how will they impact or benefit the people like the disadvantaged or the people from the poor and rural areas who cannot afford to pay cash. Some of the stores, they will tell you about FICA and need all three documents: residential, proof of residence, your bank statement, your payslip, and over and over again, you will present that when you open an account. But then, over time, maybe twice or so in a year, they will want that, or they'll want you to present such documents. And you'll ask yourself, why is FICA really expecting me to always present this to them? So I think we need to have an understanding of what really are we dealing with. I know when we were dealing with FICA last term in financing and A, I was part of that with the Honorable Chair. And there were issues that were raised, and some of the things we thought they will help. But as we go on and we experience them ourselves and we hear from our constituencies, it's a big problem. And I agree with the chairperson that we don't have to rush. We have to have an understanding, and also maybe let's hear from advocate what is his take. But I want us to understand exactly what is it that is presented before us, and also getting the views of our researchers and the content advisors. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for that. Anybody else wants to come in? Nobody. All right. Let's start with you, the team that made the submission. Thank you. And then we'll come to Treasury.
Chair, can you direct to us? Sorry?
Yeah. You made the submission. So
you can, Chair. Chair, can I just start out, and there will be some technical matters which will get addressed. This conversation has been ongoing for quite some time, many years in fact, and we have repeatedly indicated to Treasury through various workshops that they've had with the FIC and at Treasury through submissions, written submissions, the nature of our concern. We do understand the limited purview that the NCLP has in this particular matter, but we take the matter sufficiently seriously to have re-emphasized the points that we've made at every single opportunity that has been given to us. We do not have any record of reply, and I apologize if our systems have failed us in not passing through replies that have been received, but we have made repeated submissions, and the arguments that have been presented this morning are entirely consistent with positions that we've taken earlier. In respect of the issue of the other issues around specifics around clothing retailers, I think it's going to be more pertinent if I allow the industry emphasis to come from one of the specific industry members in the room to address. Jane, if you would speak to those issues.
Yes, thank you for the time today. There were comments around why is retail credit so important, and one of the things that we have done, and we did do a study that we presented in Parliament to try and demonstrate how important retail credit was for consumers. And if you look at the journey for a consumer and how eventually everybody wants to have their own house, but most people need to be able to have a credit record to be able to prove that they've got a good credit record to ever get to their house. So we showed in court that we typically are 42% of all consumers start with retail credit. We are often the first line of credit. We give out these small limits. We almost do an education part to help customers understand credit, how to use it responsibly. We keep it small. Like I said, we don't make a profit off the credit. We make a profit on the merchandise. The credit's not run for a profit. So for us, if a customer doesn't pay it back, we actually lose twice. We lose once on the credit and we lose again on the merchandise. And that's an important point, which is why I think we've always been listened to when we ask, can we be heard about credit? Because we are different from the banks. And there's nothing wrong with making profit from credit, but that's just not who we are because we're not a bank. So, and we've also shown that if you start with retail credit as opposed to a different form of credit, you're 8 times more likely to be able to get to that home loan. So we believe we're a vital part of this whole journey for our consumer and making credit affordable and helping them on that credit journey. And we do think a differentiated approach is required for us, given the nuances of how we run credit. And Gary, I don't know if you want to add anything extra to what I've said here.
Yeah, I think that just to start off, that we 100% support what is trying to be achieved. And the suggestion on tracking specific transactions, we do monitor suspicious transactions, and we're willing to put in any additional traps to catch the handful of transactions which we currently report. I think that last year we compared, I think it was under 10 transactions that needed to be reported as suspicious, and that could be expanded, and this might be a far more appropriate mechanism to track suspicious transactions through retailers than the current broad brush approach that's been proposed.
That'll be 10 out of 3.5 million.
It's it'll be well into the 20 million transactions that we process. Between ourselves, we found 10 that were flagged as suspicious. That could be expanded if there are any additional rules.
But of course, there could be many more. It's just that you would come up with 10 or 12 or whatever. Yeah. Okay, but it's fine. I think that does convey to us what you're trying to say to us. The actual figure doesn't matter that much. It just conveys a sense of what the issue might be. All right.
Chair, if I may, with the impact on the poor, that's the point of the impact assessment. We have indicated previously that there is substantive impact and that, that precedent has been quoted, but we actually believe that if no one believes us about impact on the poor, we don't need you, anyone to take our word for it. There is provision in the process around constructing legislation for impact assessments to be done. And we've indicated a specific area of concern with what we believe is likely to be a substantive economic impact on a very difficult area, a group of consumers that we should be paying a lot more attention to and being a lot more, to use that broad term, caring about. I'm not sure if there's anything that we've not specifically covered. There were more comments than questions that we managed to identify.
Well, some of the questions spilled over into national treasury. I mean, I made about 8 points, which were, I thought, mostly in the form of questions. But I think maybe we'll come back to you. I see there's a comment from Gareth in the comment chat section, something to do with Let's See Chat, to do with asking Advocate Jenkins the difference between processing regulation as opposed to a bill from a Section 75, 76 process, okay. All right, fine. Dennis, you can come in. Frank, you can come in. But unless there's a hand coming up now, there's Frank's hand up. Okay, Frank, do you want to go for it before we go back to Treasury?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to yourself and honourable members, as well as persons making the submission and staff, my colleagues. Chairperson, just to respond to Honourable Ryder's question, these regulations or these amendments to the schedules in terms of the Financial Sector Regulation Act cannot be amended by either House of Parliament. It's a question of approving it or not approving it. Submitted to Parliament for approval within a certain time, and failing that, there's a deeming provision, but if I remember correctly, but we can't amend them. We're not empowered by the Act to make amendments. So one will have to refer it back to National Treasury to take it further, Chair. Chair, just on the issue of constitutionality of these regulations, I would appreciate the citation of the case that we were referred to, but just in general, Chair, that the limitation on those rights, whether it's a Section 9 right, which is the Equality Clause, Section 10, which is human dignity, which the Constitutional Court has said finds expression in all your protected rights in the Bill of Rights. So those rights can be limited, of course, but only in terms of Section 36. And Section 36 of the Constitution envisages a balancing exercise. That's why it would be useful to get the citation of the other case. One can then look at it, because the question is the balancing exercise similar or the same? This being, I'm talking about the amendments to the schedule, being a fucked-up issue and compliance on those international levels and the implications of not complying will have a different effect. On for whatever other reason there were a request in terms of the FIC to present certain documents to make sure someone earns enough to get credit from a retailer. So, Chair, those are the things that one will have to look at. But I can say, I don't know if Treasury will come in, and I'm not trying to pass the buck, but if, as indicated to the committee, that there has been continuous engagements on the same issues that have been raised here in this committee, which would include this court case as well as the question of constitutionality, I'm sure National Treasury has already formed a view on that, and it's an assumption that I have. So we might get some advice there, Chair. That's all from me for now. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Frank. I think we're going to come back to you, right? Because we can hear Treasury, and we can hear their lawyers, but ultimately we go by what the legal services unit, well, we take everything into account, but we have to have the legal services unit on behalf of Parliament, as we have to have our staff. So can I alert the team that we really need a lot of work done on this, independent of what Treasury says. My own view, we are having a meeting of the staff later this week to discuss this. Our reports have to exercise more effective oversight, you know. I know it's difficult on the NCOP side,
except on 76 bills and all that. I hear what you're saying, Frank. But can we plead now, Frank, with you and with the staff, coordinated by Esther, Poppy, and Nkululeko, can you please help the committee to understand these issues and come to an independent view from the executive, obviously. Now, can we go to Treasury, please? I see Bukile is here. I don't know who else is here from National Treasury, but Bukile, you are probably coordinating the team from Treasury.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity to a response given given the timing of when we received the comments. Chair, if you would allow us, we would like to...
You're not very clear, but I hope if you be, I'm not a tech expert, but often they say switch off your screen, it helps, right? But let's see, you're getting a bit clearer to... All right, fine. Secondly, look, I think it's a bit unfair. You got the submission late, and I'm not expecting that you're going to reply, to give you a full reply now. So at the end of this meeting, we'll decide whether we meet on Friday or Thursday or whatever, or Friday morning. We'll decide that quickly before we pass this, before we leave this meeting. But in the meanwhile, we do need your tentative response. We can't waste any time. We can't lose this time. So, and they're here, and they can respond to you as well. So can you respond to questions? Without understanding, colleagues and the civil society stakeholders here, that the tentative response will come with a fuller response at our next meeting, which will be later this week. Right, go for it, please.
Thank you, Chair. And as you noted, what we're going to be presenting is this very initial responses, and we'll of course follow the process as you've outlined, Chair. If Janine could help me project the slide, I usually have problems simultaneously projecting and having access to my microphone. That would be useful. Chair, what we'll do is take you through some of the big highlights, the big principles that have been identified by the presenters. Those really relate to three big areas. The first is the question, Chair, of financial inclusion and trade-offs. And Chair, you and Honourable Ryder identified some really important issues in relation to this. Of course, Chair, we would all be aware of the real deleterious effects that unsecured debt has had on the lowest on the lowest earning parts of our society, and really, Chair, this is something that we've been grappling with and working very hard to address, and the impacts are severe on families and very often can be intergenerational. So I would really just maybe highlight that this broad aspect of the complexity of financial inclusion. I thought I'd just mention that at the top, Chair, just as a broad statement. In addition to that, Chair, we do of course still recognize that whenever we have to subscribe to international standards, there can be a tension between domestic implementation and the way that those are crafted. And in fact, when it comes to financial inclusion and the good aspects of financial inclusion, Chair, we've really taken a leading role at FATF, trying to ensure that whatever comes out of FATF sufficiently takes into account the impact on poorer economies and individuals, including work that we've done in making sure that jurisdictions are not wholesale de-risked, which means just cutting off entire populations from access to financial services. So that's on financial inclusion. Chair, we'll also take you through what we think addresses a lot of the concerns raised, which is this question of proportionality. Chair, exclusion does not equal proportionality, but rather a risk-based approach that we'll outline that takes into account the risk, the inherent risk of the activities being undertaken in a particular subsector, and having us have the applying a proportionate regulatory approach on those sectors. It's important to know that risk can evolve over time. If we think about maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago, perhaps dealing in scrap steel would not have been a higher risk entity. But fast forward to where we are today, I think we can all be acutely, I think we all acknowledge that the risk can evolve, and wholesale exclusions of sectors can complicate understanding evolving risk. But our colleagues from the FIC will go through that in later detail. Lastly, Chair, at the top of the presentation, we're gonna take you through what we believe will demonstrate that through the engagement over multiple years, that this does not represent what has been termed a knee jerk, but rather a some careful consideration. So if we can go on, Janine, to the next slide, please. Chair, on the consultation process followed, I'd just like to highlight that the consultation commenced in March of 2017, with the consultations of with relevant sectors and supervisory bodies continuing for the next 2 years to 2019. National Treasury published and proposed amendments to the schedules on the 19th of 2020, with the closing date of a month later, or 2 months later rather, in August. The comments were received and incorporated where relevant. Chair, the Minister then approved the amendments which we tabled at the end of March in 2022, and the amendments were then tabled on the 17th of May 2022. The Standing Committee, Chair, held public comments and we engaged with commentators at that level as well. Next slide, please, Janine. So the comments received on the schedule to the FIC during the consultation period, Chair, related to a few key areas. Sorry, Janine, I think we may have skipped two slides. Can we go back one? We seem to have a slide missing. Yeah, so maybe, sorry, go ahead. So Chair, the broad comments that we received really related to a couple of areas. The first was the exclusion of certain business sectors, which is, I guess, in line of the comments that we've heard today. We've also received a request for clarity on certain aspects of drafting, which we've accommodated where appropriate. There were 11 entities overall that commented. Chair, one requested guidance on certain aspects of the FIC in relation to crypto asset service providers. Another recommended that draft amendments be implemented before October 2022, taking into consideration submissions from relevant role players. Another Chair commented on item one of schedule two, that the JSC should be the supervisory body of authorized users of an exchange. Next slide, please. The rest of eight comments from entities raised issues in the following areas with respect to schedule one, which is accountable institutions. The first is on item two, trust and company service providers. The next was on item eight, life insurers. Then we had comments related to item 11, credit providers. And item 20, high-value goods dealers. Chair, it's important to note that one of the concerns expressed and raised during the Minister's consultation period and covered in the table of comments or in the extensive comments matrix that we produced was regarding the process that was submitted to the Committee Secretary. Chair, the National Treasury and FIC made a presentation to the Standing Committee in relation to the comments received on the 24th of August, of which I believe that today's commentators may have been a part of our standard correction. Chair, we'll then go, next slide please, Janine. Chair, we'll then deal with some of the substantive issues that were raised by today's commentators as an initial initial response, but as you outlined, Chair, these do represent initial responses, and we can provide detailed written responses as you would prefer. May I ask Peter Smith from the FIC to take us through these substantive comments, please, Chair?
Thank you very much, Nukilia, with your permission, Mr. Chair. So as Nukilia said, and I think the commentators from the NCRF has also indicated, there has been a lot of discussion on a particular issue on the exclusion of certain types of credit facilities, credit transactions, etc. And some of the wording that has been proposed has also been considered in the past. In fact, when the Minister first consulted on this issue, we made an attempt to create such a category that could be included. But that proved to be unworkable. And that was also pointed to us in some of the comments that we received from commentators in that process, the Minister's consultation process. Janine, if you can move to the next one. So I think it's important to understand, firstly, a few things. The FATF, and this has also come up in some of the questions, the FATF standard requires that lending business be included in the scope of the country's measures against against money laundering and terrorist financing. And the FATF categorizes lending business as a type of financial institution. So this is to Mr. Ryder's question earlier. The FATF doesn't consider lending as part of the designated businesses and non-professionals. They consider this to be part of the financial institutions that have to be covered. In the FATF standard, where they talk about lending, they provide a footnote to clarify that lending specifically includes consumer credit and financing of commercial transactions. So we have to take that into account in the structure, how we then translate that standard of the FATF into the legislative framework that we have. And the reference point for us to do that is the National Credit Act that defines the scope of what lending business is, how that translates into consumer credit, etc., in our domestic legislation. The difficulty that we have is that in the NCA and the categorization of credit business, the NCA defines a very wide category of credit facilities, and that covers a large range of disparate types of institutions, including the types of institutions that NCRF represents. And this is, when I said earlier, has been a challenge and why it's been why it's proven unworkable to find a way of excluding certain types of transactions. This was exactly what we experienced during the Minister's consultation process, where it was pointed out to us by a number of commentators from the private sector that these types of exclusions that we were attempting to make in each case catches a type of credit facility that actually should be included in the scope of our money laundering and anti-money laundering and terror financing legislation. Because of the wide definition or the wide category of institutions that are included in the NCA. We can move to the next slide. Some of the examples that were identified, for instance, included the types of stock cards that were mentioned again today, but those also then, by definition, covers credit cards, because those stock cards, in fact, operate as credit cards, overdraft facilities, revolving credit facilities, etc. And in the NCA, the National Credit Act, it doesn't define these by reference to the values or the volumes of transactions or the nature of the type of credit provider. In other words, the business sector in which the credit provider operates. After the representations that were made again in the Standing Committee of finance. We went back to the National Credit Regulator to confirm this and obtain the confirmation from the National Credit Regulator again of the scope of the section in the National Credit Act. Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, as you, we are also not the experts on credit law, but we did make contact with the National Credit Regulator to obtain their advice on this. And we can move to the next slide. I think it's important also to touch on the point about the risk assessment. The South African authorities, the executive, conducts ongoing regular risk assessment of our, not just the regulatory framework, but also the practical implementation of our anti-money laundering and anti-terror financing environment in order to identify where emerging risks may be coming from and what new aspects we need to be aware of so that we can react quickly and implement the correct measures, either through legislation or through policy changes, etc. But one example, I think, is, for instance, the inclusion of crypto asset service providers, which has been identified as an emerging risk. Inclusion that's also part of these amendments before you to include IRA. Those are the sort of things that have been based on risk assessment as well. What is important here is in the context of the insurance business, the risk assessment that was done there in respect of non-life providers of insurance products, in other words, short-term insurance, and their intermediaries was done in order to determine whether that sector should be included in the FIC Act scope or not. There is no international standard, and there's nothing that requires any country to in the world to include short-term insurance in the anti-money laundering framework. But in our experience, we have come across a number of instances where the engagement between the authorities and the short-term insurance provider to obtain information that the short-term insurance provider might hold of their customer would have been very useful to follow a trail of spending by a person of who's under investigation. And for that reason, we conducted a risk assessment to determine whether that would justify the inclusion of the sector in the scope of the FIC Act. The result of that was that the inclusion of the sector in the scope of the FIC Act would not be necessary, but that there would be certain arrangements for the sharing of information, the access of to customer information between authorities and the providers of short-term insurance and their intermediaries. So this, the context of this, I think, is very important to understand. Is that this, there was no international requirement that kind of required this of us, which is different in the case for credit providers. As I've explained just now. The provisions in the FIC Act relating to insurance cover what we are required to cover in terms of the international standards, in other words, long-term insurance and their intermediaries. And there's no carve-out as far as that is concerned in comparison with what we are required to cover in terms of the international standards. We can move to the next slide. So yeah, I think it's important just to emphasize here that the current scope, for instance, on insurance intermediaries is aligned with what is provided for, and again, this is where we translated the international standard into our domestic legislation using the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act, the FICE Act, as a reference point. And so the intermediaries that are required to be covered and the insurance providers that are required to be covered who are regulated under the FICE Act and under the supervision of the FCPA are also covered under the FIC Act. So you can move to the next. Then I think it's important just to point out a few things that also were mentioned in the submission today. And I think we've dealt with the time period for the comments, and I think that's not an issue for us really to consider, just to make a point that has been made before, that The conversation around this issue has been carrying on for some time, and we very clearly understand the point that is made by the commentators. We have done our utmost to give new consideration to that over the course of the process. The next slide, please. I think this is the important, maybe the most important aspect of the discussion today. The concern is that the FIC Act requires a one-size-fits-all approach to compliance with the FIC Act. In other words, the comparison was made between a retail provider and a bank. And I think that is precisely what the FIC Act does not require. The FIC Act, if you can move to the next slide. The FIC Act requires that institutions should apply a proportionate approach to their compliance with the FIC Act. Proportionate here is proportionate to their own understanding of how they are exposed to the risk of money laundering happening through their business or their financing happening through their business. I want to make it very, very clear. There is no requirement in the FIC Act whatsoever for an institution to obtain a proof of residence as part of compliance with the FIC Act. That was a requirement under the regulations under the FIC Act up until 2017. Those regulations were repealed and there's no such requirement. In fact, the FIC Act does not prescribe any measure that specific means that an institution should use in order to comply with its obligations to know who they are doing business with and to have sufficient information about their customers to mitigate the possibility that the institution might be exploited for the laundering of proceeds of crime or financing of terrorism. And I'll come back to this point just now in response to some of the specific comments, for instance, also around the constitutional court matter that was raised. I think that the bottom line or the crux of the issue for us here is that the assumption is that a credit provider has to have some information about their customer, even at the lowest end of credit provision, in order to ensure that they can recover the funds from their customer or that the customer can engage with them, they can engage with their customer in the servicing of the credit facility. And I think just to explain, and our understanding of a credit facility is similar to those of the commentators, a credit facility is an ongoing relationship with a customer that enables the customer to draw down on that credit facility, make use of the credit up to a certain limit, repay the credit, and as they repay the credit, they can make use of the credit again, and so that cycle continues, and that becomes an ongoing relationship with the customer. In that sort of environment, the institution has the flexibility under the FIC Act to determine which information they require about what they want to know about their customer in order to have identity information of their customer on their record, and what lengths they want to go to verify that information that they've obtained. So in the context of the FIC Act, if a credit provider today can access credit and can satisfy these requirements in the lowest bracket, if I can call it that, of credit provision, that's the sort of market that has been mentioned in the presentations today, and the credit provider is satisfied that they can safely provide that credit, that they are comfortable that they can manage their risk of default, for instance, on that loan, that information, in our view, should be equally sufficient to satisfy the FIC Act requirements. It is when the risk increases, the credit provision, the amount, the volume, et cetera, increases, that more information would be proportionately required and more verification would proportionately be required. And again, that would be in the discretion of the credit provider to determine what that would be. So I think the comparison, for instance, to say that credit providers would be treated as banks is entirely incorrect. And there's in the scheme of the FIC Act currently, a very large range of institutions that are covered as accountable institutions, some very small institutions and some very large complex institutions. and each one has the structure they compliance with the FICF according to the nature of their own business. We can move to the next slide. I think the cost of compliance has been mentioned, and in this case, again, the point around cost of compliance was tied to the requirement to prove residence. And as I've said, that is not a requirement under the FICS. The cost of compliance is equally not linked to the specific transaction requirements. In other words, once an institution has brought a customer into their business in this arrangement of a client relationship, an ongoing relationship with their customer, they would incur the cost of identifying the customer, obtaining the information of their customer and the verification thereof at the outset when that relationship starts. There's no repeat of that at every transaction that the customer conducts subsequently. There would be a requirement for the institution from time to time to make sure that the information with the customer is still up to date, that the customer circumstances are still the same as when they were brought into the business. And again, this would be very similar to the type of information that a credit provider would obtain of their customer over the course of servicing an ongoing credit facility. Because the customer's changing circumstances would have, in and of itself, have an impact on that credit facility. We can move to the next slide. Okay, we'll come to these. I'll quickly run through these, and then I'll come to some of the more specific points that were also raised. Mr. Chair, you mentioned that Vodacom also made a representation. We had a very quick look at the Vodacom presentation. Their presentation was on the item dealing with money remitter business. That is item 19 in the schedule 1 to the FIC Act. And the questions that Vodacom asked is what would be the impact of the this item on a business that provides money remittance business in addition to a different type of business that falls completely outside of the scope of the FIC Act. Now, I think firstly it's important to understand that the amendment that is provided here is to bring so-called informal or alternative remittance providers also into the scope of the FIC Act. A remittance business is a very strictly regulated business under the exchange control regulations, and it is supervised by the Financial Surveillance Department of the South African Reserve Bank. And any institution that is currently already authorized under those regulations to remit funds would be an accountable institution under this item 19. Theoretically, that category of business also would include the businesses that provide the same service but who are not formally registered or authorized by the Financial Surveillance Department of the Reserve Bank. The confirmation that this amendment provides is more for legal certainty to ensure that it's clear that those informal remittance providers would be considered to be a money remitter and would fall under the scope. Albeit that they would not be operating with the authorization of the Reserve Bank. So to Vodacom's question, an institution that provides this business and is a registered money remitter in terms of the exchange control regulation would have to comply with the FIC Act for that portion of its business for which it is registered. If it also does a different line of business, in this case it would be a telecommunications business, that falls outside the scope of the FIC Act, and the FIC Act would not apply to the business in that context. It would be up to the business to decide whether it's simply easier for them to apply the same onboarding processes, et cetera, across their business, or whether they want to ring-fence that for their remittance business and not apply to the rest of their business. But there would be no FIC Act implication there. So I think that deals with all the comments that we've received. Okay, yeah, I think that just confirms the point I was making that the scope of the item 19 extension is not to affect businesses that are not currently already providing this, but to bring in the informal business side of the business as well. Can I then see if there's another slide? I think just to round up, and this is also important for the discussion today, to understand what the implications are for the in future for new sectors that are coming in, including the credit provider sector, but also the others that are that will become accountable institutions. For instance, the very good dealers and the likes, where those categories of business are not accountable institutions at the moment. The first requirement for them will be to register with the FIC Act. And it's this, I want to emphasize, there's no cost, there's no formality, there's no requirement authorization required for registration. It's simply an act of making use of the registration portal that the FIC provides online. Providing the information about the entity that is registering, which point of contact, etc., will be for the duration of its business as an accountable institution. There are no fees requirements, and registration is not a barrier to doing business. Then there will be guidance, formal guidance products provided, guidance documents on the application of the FIC Act, what the FIC Act requires of institutions, especially explaining the risk-based approach, the proportionate compliance requirements. A lot of this guidance is already was already developed and provided before, and that will be brought to the attention of the new categories of institutions. Some of the new categories require sector-specific guidance, and the FIC is already in the business or in the process of developing the first draft of those. In the context of guidance, any new guidance that the FIC will issue must first be put through a process of consultation with the affected sectors so that they can contribute to the formulation of the guidance. And that is something that is hard-coded in the FIC Act. No guidance can be issued without the consultation process. So that will be part and parcel of the process of new guidance that will be developed. For the specific sectors that where that may be required. On the inspection and enforcement side, the FIC understands, and not just the FIC, the other sector supervisors understand that a new category of institutions cannot be expected to comply with the FIC Act on the day that the FIC Act becomes applicable to them. That has never been the case in the past when new categories of institutions were brought into the scope of the FIC Act or when the provisions of the FIC Act were amended over the years. So with that understanding, the sector supervisors and the FIC follow an approach where we engage with the sectors and monitor their ability to bed down their compliance programs, their internal structures for compliance with the FIC Act, and allow a period for that to take effect and mature. And in our past experience, that has been roughly 12 to 18 months, depending on the sophistication of level of sophistication in a particular sector. It is only once the sector-specific supervisors for the FIC are satisfied that institutions are able and have had made use of the time to adapt to comply with the FIC Act that a supervisor would start considering any enforcement action against an accountable institution for non-compliance with the FIC Act. I think just to pick up on the point of the Constitutional Court judgment, obviously I've not had, the team here have not had the opportunity to study the judgment, but just at face value, we believe there is a significant point of distinction, and that lies in the point that I made earlier, that the FIC Act does not require specific documentation from does not prescribe specific documentation that an accountable institution should obtain from its customers. The institution that does business with its customers must determine what information it requires from its customer and how it will verify that information that it requires from its customer and whether it needs any documentation at all. In many cases, the verification is not done with the providing any documentation, depending on the nature of the business. So proof of residence is certainly something that is not required, and there's no prescription around that. And I think that would be an important point of distinction in this instance. The question of whether this requirement for credit providers to identify their customers, conduct due diligence on their customers, the level of due diligence required, etc., whether that will be exclusionary or not, I think very much depends on how the credit providers themselves implement this legislation. And I think in some of the comments that are, for instance, from Honorable Mashlangu, if a credit provider today asks a customer for FICA documentation, they are grossly misrepresenting the current requirements to that customer because there is no such requirement on a credit provider to ask for FICA documentation. So I think that is the sort of thing that we want to address through guidance and through engagement with the sector and to understand very clearly what the expectations are that institutions with the providers themselves, accountable institutions would have of their customers, and to what extent that is aligned with their obligations to comply with the FIC Act. The FIC Act wording in the due diligence requirements is that the institution itself must be satisfied that it knows who its customer is. And we believe credit providers are in a position to do that as a natural aspect of the type of business that they are in. It would have been very different, for instance, if we were dealing with a different type of retail sector that deals with customers on a once-off basis and would not have any interest in having a long-term ongoing engagement with a customer. I've dealt with the exclusion point, I think it is important for us to reiterate that, especially where the international standards require us to cover a particular category, that we do not advise any exclusion or carve out for that category that is required to be covered by the international standards. In our case, or in our view, the argument for such a carve-out can only be made if we are convinced that there is no risk of money laundering or terror financing in that sector. If there is risk, even if it's low risk, that risk needs to be managed through the provisions that the FIC Act and other legislation provides for. The question of whether an industry should be included in the FIC Act that is not covered by the international standard, obviously that is something that is in our own interest and in our own discretion. And where that is clearly motivated by risk, that is the case for us to include such a category in the scope of the FIC Act. There was a question or a point, I think, from Honourable Ryder on retrospective application. I think just to emphasise that these amendments do not have a retrospective application. Retrospective implementation of legislation can only be done if legislation specifically and expressly provides for retrospective application. And that is not the case in this instance. So this does not mean that credit providers or any other category of accountable institution has to go back in history and obtain information. What they would have to do, though, I think it's important to us to understand also is in the context of updating information at regular points in future, that is something that is in the hands of the accountable institution themselves. It's to determine how often and when they want to update information, what information they need to update, and with the regularity with which they need to do that. That is part and parcel of the proportion of the risk-based process for institutions to comply with the due diligence obligations of the FICA. So it may mean, for instance, in the ordinary run-of-the-mill low-risk retail sector that a customer would be required to update information once a year, once even 2 or 3 years, depending on the need of the institution itself. It might be that the institution needs that updating more regularly than that, not for FICA compliance, but for its own business purposes. And that would then be aligned with the way that the institution chooses to do the business. I think just on the point of alternative wording and the, also the proposal that was made by the NCRF, as I said in the beginning, it's difficult for us to provide alternative wording which does not have a precise legal certainty when we describe a category of accountable institutions. Actually, it's not difficult. It's something that should be avoided at all costs. Because if it's not precisely clear in the description of a category of accountable institution, and there's no legal certainty around that, neither the FIC nor the supervisors nor the industry themselves would understand when does an institution fall within this category, when does the act apply to them, and when does it not. So the lines need to be drawn very clearly in black and white to describe what is an accountable institution and what isn't. Terms that do not have legal definition, therefore bring in vagueness in the descriptions, which is in and of itself a ground to strike down an amendment such as this. I think that has been our challenge, especially in this area of credit providers and in the context of the National Credit Act, which is our legal point of reference that we have to make use of for the purpose of legal certainty. Lastly, some of the questions that the chair had raised. The FATF requirements and how that applies to specific requirements that the FIC the South African authorities implement in South Africa. The FATF standard is not prescriptive on the types of documents that means the measures that institutions should be required to use when they conduct due diligence. The FATF standard is actually very clear, expressed on this, that institutions should be required to make use of the information that is available in a particular country system to comply with the requirements to meet the expectations of the standards for institutions to do due diligence and to know their customers, to be able to identify when suspicious transactions should be reported, etc. And the FATF has been very focused on this issue because of the issue of financial exclusion. And I've been at pains over the last 10 years or so to make clear that countries might use of the flexibility that the FATF standard provides when they construct their national legislation to implement the standards. So countries that provide for very strict requirements in their national legislation that have an exclusionary effect are actually penalized in the FATF's view, in their assessment. Because in FATF's view, that actually makes the system less effective to combat money laundering and terror financing. And the FATF comments on these types of examples where they find them in their assessment processes. So there's no requirement for the FATF, for instance, for a country to ask for proof of address or any other particular information as far as that is concerned. On the constitutional court challenge, I think it's also important to understand that the challenge would not arise in a vacuum. So when a particular regulation is made, or law is passed, regulations are passed, or in this case, this type of amendment to the scope of the act is made, the Constitutional Court will not entertain a hypothetical question in the abstract to ask is this constitutionally valid or not. There would have to be an application of the regulation or the law in some particular form, and the defense against that from the affected party would be that the law in itself is constitutionally valid and therefore should not be enforced. So in the context of the amendments to the FIC Act schedule, that would mean that the supervisor would have to impose an administrative sanction for non-compliance against an institution. And the institution would then challenge the constitutionality of the FIC Act and the requirement to apply the FIC Act requirements to that type of institution on a constitutional basis. For the matter to come before the Constitutional Court and for the Constitutional Court to consider the question. So in the absence of a specific reason for the Constitutional Court to consider the question, it's not likely that it would arise in the context of these amendments, but the process now to bring about the amendments or to bring the amendments into force. Unfortunately, I do not have the specifics on the to comment on the example of Botswana, except to say that Botswana was placed in a very, very difficult position when the FATF considered that Botswana's measures to deal with money laundering and terror financing were not in line with the standard, and Botswana was grey-listed. The impact of that was that, and this applies to any grey-listed country, that the European Union then declared Botswana as a high-risk jurisdiction, and all banks in the European Union had to apply very strict measures for dealing with banks in Botswana, including the South African subsidiaries that operate in Botswana. And that was the reason for the urgency for Botswana to make sure that it was able to address the actions that were required of it to be removed from the FATF grey list, and then consequently, or later on subsequently, to be removed from the list of high-risk jurisdictions by the European Union. Now, I don't know if the issue of credit providers was part of the scope of what Botswana had to do. That's something we can look into and how that was dealt with, if it was the case in the case of Botswana. But I thought it was just important to explain the sort of more the general background on how Botswana came to be listed and what the effect of that was for the country. I think I've covered all the specific points. If I haven't, please remind me and I'll try my best to pick up on some of those. Thank you, Vakili. I'll hand back to you.
Thank you, Chair. That's it from our side. So.
Okay, colleagues, can I make a suggestion about process, right? But I'm not sure that this is the best way to go forward. Instead of us putting questions immediately to Treasury, maybe it's better we ask the Federation, the Retail Clothing Federation, to respond to them. Because you see, speaking from a very subjective point of view, I thought that they had a very good case. The Retail Clothing Federation. And then I heard the response from Treasury and the FIC. And I feel they also have quite a credible case. I think it's too soon to decide. So before I say anything, I would prefer that, excuse me, we have the Federation's reply first. But let me see what colleagues said. Is there any view on that, colleague?
There's a lot to digest, and I think there's two very different approaches. I think certainly from my perspective, I think there's a little more research needed to try and get to the bottom. But let's hear as much as we can. Yeah,
okay. In that case, shall we go for that? Then is anybody else with a contrary view in Kurilik, or do you see any hand up?
No, I didn't see any hand up.
Okay. All right. Can you reply? Because it's quite a formidable reply to you. Although I don't think they've answered many questions either. Willie's also got load shedding with us. It's going to be a nightmare this week, I know. We've had 4 hours already, but I'm fine till 2 o'clock. Right. Go for it, our stakeholders here.
Chair, thank you. We do appreciate it. And thank you to Treasury for the response. Chair, the first thing I'd like to say is the context of Treasury's response does indicate that we have made repeated attempts to engage on this matter. They have and there are a couple of times where they've quoted slightly outdated earlier responses rather than our more updated ones. I am going to, as I've done before, ask for more specific legal response from the team and or industry response from the team. We would appreciate a copy of that presentation. We have struggled in previous times to get a copy of.
Nkululeko will send it to you right now. He's very good. Thank you so much, Chair.
And then let me hand over to the team for now, and I'll make some more specific comments from my side as well. If we could start on the legal side, please. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So obviously, once we've had the opportunity to study the presentation in detail, we will provide more specific responses. But just some quick points of clarification that we just wanted to note right now while we have everyone on the same meeting. It appears to us as if the wording that was being referred to in the presentation was the initial wording that was submitted by the NTRF on their 12 August submission to the National Assembly Committee, rather than the current wording which has been submitted to the NTOP, which, as we discussed at the beginning of this submission, is a lot more refined because it takes only into account the store credit in a closed-loop environment. The previous submission proposed to exclude credit facilities and credit transactions as a whole, whereas currently what we are proposing is a much limited scope. So that's the first thing I want to say. I just wanted to make clear that we aren't proposing a wholesale exclusion of credit facilities and credit transactions. We understand that could cause problems. Then the other thing
to expedite things and move things faster. Treasury, when you come back to us later this week, will you reply specifically to this one? Fine, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair. The other thing is we are fully cognizant that the FIRC does apply a risk-based approach, and that, strictly speaking, the proof of residence might not necessarily be a requirement in law. But what has been our experience in practice is that it is still something that is looked at in investigations and enforcement matters by the FIRC. So that's just something that we will obviously respond in more detail later, but we would like to note that right now. And I think that ultimately, a lot of the questions that have arisen goes back to the fact that no MLT risk assessment has been done for the sector. So the practical implications for both the FIRC and the parties impacted by this change haven't been looked at and merged and discussed together. And ultimately, I think that that's inescapably where we are right now, and that's why there's so many questions and very few answers.
And just if I may comment on the constitutional risk to this, our submission is not that it would be struck down simply on its terms. It is the impact. It is the impact that it will have. And as Karen just referred to, no assessment has been done. And if the regulation is passed in its current form, so we're instructed and so we our clients assess, there will be this impact, and it's the impact which in the previous case was discriminatory, and for that reason it was struck down. So there will have, obviously there will be time and one will assess the impact. Unfortunately, if it's been passed already, one can't change the impact, but one may have to seek legal recourse for that. And just one other comment on retrospectivity. We're not suggesting that it's retroactive in the sense that it automatically applies as if it had been promulgated years ago. But the impact, and I think we probably on the same page with Treasury on this, the impact in a very short space of time is that everybody that is on any credit provider's books will be swept into the net, and thereby effectively the regulation becomes retrospective, because you cannot ignore, and certainly in an audit by the FIRC, it would be no answer to say, well, this is someone who's been on my books for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Everyone will be swept into the net, and the impact is that it effectively is retrospective in the sense that it covers everyone on your books and with the attendant costs and inconvenience and so forth. Thank you. So, Chair, thank you. We have received the presentation and it's circulated to our team. We will commit to making a reply in respect of that in writing within a very short space of time before you meet and submit it to the Secretariat. But Chair, our substantive position has not changed, which is what we end up with here is a position where still one size fits all. The regulatory framework will become a one size fits all. The application of the law will become a one size fits all. And in a very, very short space of time, the nature of concerns that we have and as in respect of practical implementation will actually become highly prejudicial to the consumer base that we've identified and spoken about here. And we'll touch on that and speak to that further in our written submission. But thank you. We'll keep our short response to Treasury in that group.
Treasury, do you want to reply before we come in to these things, tentative as they may be, your reply? Hello, Bukile? Peter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just very quickly, we have tried to apply our mind to as best as we can to the new proposed wording, but I think concern is still that the terminology of scorecards, closed loop, etc., are things that are used in practice and not legally defined. So it might still make it difficult to determine exactly what the scope would be, what would be included, and what would not be included, even if those terms are used in the description of this item in the FIT Act. I think the challenge that we have here is the commentators, the NTRF, are looking at this from their own understanding of how this is applied in their own industry. But this is not something that is restricted to their industry only. Any type of trader provider can make use of the same business model and provide the same closed loop scorecard in a completely different environment in a different risk category. And that's the sort of thing that I was trying to refer to earlier that makes it very difficult for us find the precise ring fencing to exclude something if you want to exclude something entirely from the scope of the FIT Act. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any hands up in Kodalek? I don't see any. Well, some people are from the clock with the load shedding. Is anybody wants to raise anything, Kodalek? Can you see anybody?
No, Chair, there are no hands.
All right. So, you know, colleagues, I would like to suggest that both sides may not want to do this because they're fed up with reaching out to each other. So the obligation is on Treasury, really. We're not going to rush this bill. And we have a limited time because of our commitment to plenary sittings, and you well know that the same people serve in two committees and in appropriations and so on. So, you know, it's in your interest to meet. I suggest you meet outside this forum and see if you can arrive at some consensus on what to do, because both sides seem to have credible arguments, although on the surface to me, my first sense is that Treasury has got a stronger, much stronger case here, at least for now, which is why I stress again that the team, and Kumuleko, can you coordinate the team and get it going from our side? Frank, can you help us also? But some of the issues that can be dealt with now or later in this week would revolve around, and if the team can send some questions to Treasury as well to settle by the next meeting, which we'll decide on now, tentatively set for Friday, and let's see if there are consensus about time and so on. The first thing then is, I'm not very clear, Peter, did the FIC do a sector study or not? Secondly, if I understand you, there is no requirement from FATF that, no prescription, in other words, that small credit providers, if that's how they could be called, require the proof of residence. They don't prescribe, but they seem to say use your existing
provisions and ensure you implement them or tighten them. Is that correct, if I understand it correctly? The question that I don't fully understand is the gripe from the Federation with Treasury or more with DTIC, the National Credit Regulator, because there are existing provisions for how they must behave. So as I understand it, you just consult the NCR, and if DTIC was properly consulted and, you know, agreed to what is the current version of the bill before us, I mean, they're the overseeing authority there with the NCR. Can we just, like, make changes without consulting the Select Committee on, you know, trade, industry and competition? I don't know. I noticed the National Credit Act doesn't exclude retailers. I think that's correct. These were the very same changes to SCOF, and SCOF didn't accept them. Can somebody, Tracy, can you reply? What was SCOF's argument? Why did they finally say no? On Botswana level, yes, please, can Treasury and our advocate Jenkins help us with that? I think I buy the argument that credit providers are not treated as banks. I mean, then on the cost of compliance, I mean, they seem to have a case. Can you reply to these things either now in writing, Federation? Cost of compliance so far now is one sort of thing. On the constitutional issue, Peter, as far as I know it, you know, a bill, a clause in a particular bill, or an entire bill can be taken to court even before it's promulgated to be challenged for its constitutionality. Sometimes people have taken a bill to court and it becomes an act by the time the court decides, but it takes one or two clauses in section that says, this is unconstitutional. The courts have found sometimes in the favor of the litigants and sometimes in the favor of the state. So I don't know what you mean that it only become something before the courts if it's applied and some person is adversely affected and takes it to court. Although, of course, that will probably be a lower income earner and they'll have to go to a legal services unit or something. I mean, legal resources and so on. To challenge that. I'm not utterly convinced that there is a parallel between that decision taken already and the current one before us, but I don't know. Somebody might ask you, Treasury, if it's not a FATF requirement of residence, why have it? Are you going to argue it's there already? But it can't be there already because they're saying they now have to apply. The other option is to give this sector more time to implement it. But now, Frank points out that if it's a regulation, you either accept it or reject it. You can't amend it. But in the report, we can say we don't accept it, and we suggest that they come back with the regulation in this form and pass it within 14 days or whatever of its tabling in the houses or such things. Then on the Vodacom story, the Vodacom presentation, which I read while listening to the participants in today's meeting, I'm a bit befuddled, really. I need to read it more carefully. But I'm a bit surprised that Vodacom, such a powerful company with a battery of lawyers internally and externally that they draw from, didn't understand what you are saying, Peter. I mean, it sounds a bit odd that they suddenly at the last minute come to us. So I really find it puzzling. Your answer came across like a very simple, but yet they didn't seem to understand. So Frank, you should also apply your mind, the team with Esther, and I think Esther just left because I'm presumably of the load shedding, but Poppy presumably is here. And Kulileko, can you coordinate that, Brin? I think maybe we should have a brief meeting this afternoon and decide on the way forward. Let me start then with you as the Federation. Do you want to respond to anything I've just said?
Thank you, Chair. Let me just say we are quite happy to meet with Federation if opportunity arises to do so as urgently as necessary in the context of the timetable both of the committee and the Commission. Thank
you. You don't want to say anything in response to anything I've said? For now, to expedite this. Because you can meet, remember, Parliament ultimately decides. You guys can even agree, so to speak, but I mean guys, I mean a plural sense. Right. But I'm saying ultimately we decide. So you know, it's not as if you can sit there and come to a conclusion. It just makes our task a bit easier, but ultimately take our guidance from the parliamentary support team and, you know, we decide as politicians. And we could be wrong in a technical matter like this. So that's why we're cautious about treading, you know, the way we go about things. This is not an easy, it's not like a clear policy decision on these issues. The policies are clear. We mustn't penalize the poor and so on and so on, but we mustn't overburden them with credit. They can't pay that structure, unsecured debt as it's called, and so on. So finding those balances too, there's no like policy. It's a case-by-case matter. And ultimately, you go by your political instinct when you find the sun. But you're also guided by what a committee that's primarily involved in this has decided on, which is our partners in the National Assembly. But having said that, is there anything else you want to say quickly?
Chair, I'm looking at a number of elements that touch on the National Credit Act and the role of the National Credit Regulator, which we appreciate does bring in a complexity to the process. Yeah. And again, Chair, what we think may be more useful instead of having a ping-pong backwards and forwards with Treasury, again, which is why I just brought the summary point, is it may just be a lot more useful that we sit with them and try and iron out what may hopefully just be a few kinks in the process. And if there is a substantial difference that cannot be resolved, then yes, we need to put ourselves in the hands of Parliament and respond as necessary beyond that.
Yeah, I like that idea. That did occur to me. I can only propose it. I don't have the authority. Our committee doesn't instruct the NPR to meet you. Well, we may do, actually. We have Parliament, but we have to consult with the Select Committee. We have to brief them on this bill. It's not an easy process, but we also have some deadlines. There's yet another bill coming in this area to avoid, as you know, the FATA grey listing prospects. So having said that, can I get the committee's view? Now, are there any hands up that we strongly recommend that the parties meet in the next 48 hours and then come back to us with a response where you say we agree on this and we disagree on this and these are the areas of disagreement. That will just help us. When I say parties, I mean obviously Treasury, FIC, and the Federation. But if Treasury can negotiate for the NPR to be there and officials of DTIC, because it's the ministry that brings bills to Parliament, not the regulator. I don't know what latitude the regulator has got to devise regulations, but presumably a table and also in the relevant portfolio committee and select committee. So for now, that is my suggestion. Bukile, what do you think? Is it doable? Are you in, Bukile? Is anybody else from Treasury? Tell us, is your hand up? Or is it an old hand?
No, it is up, but it's been up for quite some time.
Sorry, I'm sorry. No,
not a problem. No, it's fine. There was a flow, so I didn't want to interrupt. But yeah, just thanks to Eskom for helping me ensure I'm outstanding in my field.
Chair, I'm going to ask a practical question. How are you connected now? Are you connected to your 4G?
There's a cell phone tower, but it's directionally dependent. So I've got to rush out and come and stand under the trees in the yard.
in order to get signal on the cell phone.
Yes, but the problem I have here where I am, I used to be able to connect when the Wi-Fi collapsed because of load shedding, right? But then I use my 4G or 5G, the relevant mask, the word mask, is constantly being, because apart from the load shedding of Eskom, we have municipal load shedding, right? We have a lot of them. You can't connect. So once my Wi-Fi goes, I can't connect to the 4G. And I'm sorry to raise these things, but they become very practical this week because it's level 6, possibly level 7. So I don't know how others do, but it's not possible for me. I hope Injadu and Mamara Fatah are listening. Because the meeting is going on. Yeah. Okay, quickly.
What I've experienced is that the batteries are just not getting enough time to recharge, the ones that power the mast. So, yeah, it gives us about an hour of coverage, and then we also sit like it's 1970 again. But, just on the matter at hand, I do think that a meeting is important. And I think that you know, the question from Vodacom, the inputs from Treasury responding to the Federation saying that there was a misunderstanding about, what the implications are. All of these things point to kind of a lack of certainty and perhaps a lack of clarity that is brought about by the regulations. That's specifically why I said I thought that I need to do a little bit more research between now and Friday. I've asked for some information, as you saw, because I do believe that there's kind of a lot of grey area here, and we're not all getting the same understanding from the regulations as they've been presented. So that lack of clarity, I think, is perhaps what's causing the issue. So I do think that sitting around a table is going to be of tremendous assistance to the role players, but also important for us to kind of get the signal that people out there are not sure, even with the legal minds behind Vodacom, etc., they're not sure of the impact of these regulations. They seem to be very heavy-handed. If they're not so heavy-handed, I think Treasury needs to respond to us and kind of really make us comfortable with that. But I do believe that we need to get a better understanding and there needs to be more clarity. So, yeah, please go away, have a chat to each other by all means, and let's see where we can find common ground. But I do think that there's a lot more work to be done for me as well. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, can other members comment, please? Because, it's just two of us have said they should go and meet, which is the process we do use in situations like this. It's not unprecedented. So maybe I should ask, is there anybody in the committee that's opposed to this discussion that will take place before we meet on Friday? In Kululeko, I don't see any hands up, but then some people might have fallen away.
No, Chairperson, there are no hands.
All right, then in that case, we are proposing that, as far as I know, it's legally binding, or not from the Parliament. It's never not happened before when we suggested it. We haven't done this in this term of Parliament, but in the NA side, when the committee and I were doing it, did it several times. It does help. Otherwise, we're going to sit here for hours and hours in Kiele, Peter, because we ain't just going to vote on this bill, right? We're not allowed to do so. We have to understand all the issues, and it takes hours and hours to be. We prefer it, right? As you pointed out at Section 12, yeah, we did do that, yeah. Oh, man, that was even more challenging. I remember now, yes. It's going to help all parties, Bukile. So our view is, come to us after you've had a discussion. Parliament has done that many times. It has assisted all of us, including Parliament, to process things expeditiously. You don't meet, it's going to mean sitting here for many, many hours. And this is not a bill we can dilly-dally on either. But on the other hand, there's nothing. Fatah doesn't, and Treasury cannot override the Constitution and our obligations as a parliamentary committee. That won't happen, okay? And it can't happen. So, you know, the choice is yours, Bukile. You're on your team. Yeah, so over to you, Bukile. Will you guys meet with them? They say they're fine to meet with you in the next 48 hours. We meet on Friday.
Certainly, Chair. Thank you so much. Chair, can I just confirm what form you'd like us to revert to you? Is that in a response document to be sent to you? Is that the form of communication you'd prefer, just to
Make sure. Firstly, what I'm saying is, you must do what you're meant to do, which is present the answers for our record. It helps us also to shape our, I see Poppy is here, Poppy, it helps to shape our draft report. So the draft report would say, in our meeting, the Federation raised the following five issues. This was Treasury's reply. So we need your replies to set the record, right? And even if this does go to the Constitutional Court, you know, not that we're afraid of that. We've never been afraid of that. You know, at least they have an idea of what the issues were before at least our committee, and presumably they'll want to know what happened at Scott. So, please, do that reply. But in the meanwhile, I mean, what you could do is even do the reply before you meet the Federation, right? Then you meet the Federation, and when you come back, you can just do a simple overview. Look, on these four issues we agreed, on these two issues we couldn't find each other, and on these two issues we will never agree, okay, or whatever it is, right, for these reasons. That's all we want from you. Now, we would like to meet Nkululeko. I think if need be, I'll ring the House Chair also. He's never turned up. Instead, colleagues of meeting at an odd hour like 5 p.m. or was it 4:30 p.m. on Friday, because the House has got a special arrangement, as important as it is, on the Women's Charter in one of the provinces. Can we seek a meeting for 10 o'clock in Nkululeko?
Okay, Chairperson, I will submit an application to that effect.
Yeah, and I will ring Jomo and Ms. Nyambi if there's not a reply quickly. So we will let you know by tomorrow around noon at the latest, because you have to get permission to meet while the House is having some workshop, or is it, I think it's the Women's Charter, it doesn't go from province to province. So, in short, we're tentatively meeting at 10, but if need be, we'll meet in the afternoon. If it's absolutely out, then we will meet next Tuesday. If you need more time, if you come back to us by Thursday, 1 o'clock, but say, guys, we can't do it, contact Nkululeko, and he will discuss it with me, and I take it the committee will finally meet on Tuesday. Rather, we have an expeditious processing of the issues than sit here and have endless hours of discussions that sometimes fly over our head. Okay? So, we can't meet next week. Parliament rises. Yeah, well, if that's the case, yeah, of course. Sorry, let me just look at what it says in the chat. Oh, yeah, Parliament rises this week. Parliament says we can meet National Treasury at our tomorrow. Yeah, well, that's something you can discuss through the phone. I think you just exchange phone numbers. Yeah, we would like to meet on Friday, you see, but at the end of the day in Nkululeko, I think we should try to meet at 10. That's our first option. If we can't, in any case, can I point out that because Parliament's not sitting next week, I thought it was sitting, well, an earlier program is that for next week. Okay. Since Parliament's not sitting next week, in any case, we can't rush the bill to the House. We can only vote on the bill in the fourth quarter. So, yeah, we can even meet next Tuesday. Yeah, I was going to suggest what Dennis is saying. There's no reason why we can't seek a meeting for next Tuesday morning during the constituency period. So can I go to Treasury and if I see, can you meet with them before Friday, 10 o'clock, say by Thursday night, or would you prefer to defer things until next Tuesday? What would you prefer, Vukile?
Chair, on our side, we're happy to meet before this week.
So you'd rather we meet on Friday?
Yes, Chair, but may I just double check with our FIC colleagues, but certainly on our side, that shouldn't be a problem.
Right.
Yes, certainly, Mr. Chair, from our side as well, we will be happy to join the meeting.
I see some members think next Tuesday won't work. All right, so look, basically here it is, right? We're going to meet at 10 o'clock on Friday. If you guys have not satisfactorily met our requirement to meet and discuss, and it's not nominal, okay? You don't just meet for the sake of meeting. This is addressed to the state agencies, yep. Because that's what half the time happens. The Treasury doesn't, actually. I know people endlessly complain about Treasury not consulting, and when you look at what we see, that's not true. What they mean is they couldn't get what they wanted, so they blame Treasury for lack of consultation. So, and I've noticed that this thing has been on the agenda for 2 years and more, right? Tuesday will work for me. It's just going to be, oh, all right. Well, whatever. We've agreed on Friday at 10 o'clock for now. Only we have to get permission from the powers that be, and you will be notified. If it's not 10 o'clock, it'll be sometime in the afternoon. Okay? So it is on Friday, so people are not affected with the constituency period. Thank you. Is there anything else? No. Okay. Thank you then. And we shall meet next week. Sorry, on Friday. Friday. Thank you, everybody. The meeting is drawn to a close. Unless, is any other hands up? I don't see any other hands up.
I don't see any hands up.
All right, thank you, then we are done.
Thank you all.